So this week's parsha is Matot. We're going to deal with something which is actually was very difficult for me to prepare. There are certain topics that weren't difficult. I mean, you know that the easiest things to prepare are ones where there are narratives. And the easiest of narratives is when a narrative is mentioned more than once, then you just have to compare the narrative one place to the other and fill it in. And then, you know, the class almost writes itself. And especially if there's some kind of trauma and so on, then we get to analyze it. The topics that I always found the most difficult are topics when have to do with maps. So, of course, this week has to do with map. And then there's another issue that what we're going to do today probably, I'm saying probably just because I'm downplaying it, but probably has an implication in terms of halakha as well, in terms of Jewish law. So that also makes it a little bit more difficult because then you have to be responsible in terms of Jewish law. I presume that no one's going to rule any laws based upon what I'm saying today, and at least it will be perhaps a foundation of something which would need to be discussed, but let's begin. It's Perek Lamed Bet, and it is somewhat of a narrative. Umikne Rav haya lebnei Reuven uvnei Gad. So it sets up the situation by telling us that they had a lot of flock, and they had a lot of mikne. Actually, it comes from the word acquisitions. So acquisitions meaning they had a lot of money. So, but money in those days was very often defined by having cattle. So these were people who had acquired wealth. But it's not just umikne rav. There's another qualifier there. Umikne rav yelabnei ruvein lebnei gad atzum ma'od. So you have atzum, which is a lot, and ma'od is very, and a very lot of rav. I mean, apparently they had a lot. V'yirut eretz yazer v'etz eretz gilad v'inei makom makom mikne. And they look and they see that this place, which we're not defining exactly where it is yet, was a place which was very good for grazing. And they come over and they make the following first statement, then request. So you notice there is some God consciousness there, which is also one of the things that we always are on the lookout for. Eretz miknehi, it's a place for the flock. Ula avdecha mikneh, which is also, again, interesting the way that they're approaching. There's a little bit of deference, not a little, there's deference over here to the leadership, to Moshe, and the other leaders, and say, avdecha, you know, your servants, we have flock, which, by the way, is an understatement, because they don't have flock, they have a lot of atzum ma'od flock. Vayomru, and they say, im matzanu chen be'enecha, if we have found favor in your eyes, yutan et ha'aretz hazot la'avadecha la'achuza, give us this place, al ta'avirenu et ha'yardein, and don't force us to cross over the Jordan. So I do want to point out that there's two different statements over here, and they could have been worked out differently. One statement is that this is a wonderful place for grazing. So they could have used it for grazing. They could have made the request, we'd like to use this place for grazing. And the second thing they said is, we don't want to cross the Jordan. That's not the same thing. Let's go a little bit further with this into themes that we should all recognize by now. There are people who live in the Middle East who are called the Bedouin. If you want long lectures on the Bedouin, you will talk to Naomi, and she will tell you everything you need to know about the Bedouin. The Bedouin historically, despite certain claims today or recent claims, never really were connected to any particular piece of land because they would go wherever the grazing was better at that particular time, which means the place of grazing was something which is situational, is seasonal, based on climate, based on rainfall, based on all kinds of things. And one of the beautiful things about this is that you just graze and you let them go from place to place to place to place. And therefore, it's not necessarily land connected. So theoretically, there could have been a situation where they would have had crossed the Jordan with everybody else, perhaps have taken a place to live someplace near the Jordan Valley at some point up or down the coast, and then had their flocks, had permission to use that area, which has been captured, to graze. Which means what I'm trying to point out is that there's two different issues over here. One issue is we'd like this for area for grazing. The second area is we don't want to cross over the Jordan and be with everybody else. Those are not the same things, and therefore their problem or their request could have been solved differently. The other thing that this causes us then to recall, and I'll tell you, it is a major theme, and I'm going to be giving a talk on this, I think, at some point next week. I was first really alerted to this when Rabbi Soloveitchik had given a talk, and I was not there for this talk. This was may have been before I was born, but it was one of his Zionist talks, which were collected in a book called either, originally in Yiddish, it was Four Fear Drashot, and then in Hebrew it became Chamesh Drashot. They found some other drashot to throw in. And then in English, they somehow translated that into The Rav Speaks. And any of you have ever felt like, oh, Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings are too difficult, I can't understand it, so read this book. Read this book. It's called The Rav Speaks. Read it. Not only is it readable, but it's his Zionist manifesto, as it were, was written and then translated into other languages. Send me an email afterwards and I'll send you all the information. In one of his talks, he speaks about Yosef and the brothers. And it was, I mean, the background for the whole issue was the his point there really was that Yosef saw the present situation through the prism of the future, while the brothers saw the situation through the prism of the present and the past. And that was really a metaphor for the different Torah leaders in Europe in the turn of the previous century, which means going from the 1800s into the 1900s, whereby there were those who felt that they had been in Europe for hundreds of years, they're going to stay in Europe. While others had felt, no, that there's going to be some kind of a major shift taking place. And he basically tried to show that through the discussion of Yosef and the brothers, but he talked about Yosef's dream. And he pointed something out, which is so obvious, a lot of times he would do this and then you'd say to yourself, why didn't I ever see that? Why didn't I ever notice that? Why didn't I ever think about that? And he points out that the difference between that Yosef has this dream where they all have sheaves, and their sheaves bow down to his sheaves. So he says, so what bothered them about the dream? So the answer is that Yosef's dream is of being farmers. Well, their dream, farmers who grow sheaves. Well, their occupation was actually shepherds. So therefore, the disconnect over here in the dream is not just that, you know, they had more flock or he has more flock and so on. No, but suddenly they're talking about sheaves. So what's the difference between sheaves versus flock? Well, the answer is that in order to grow anything, you need a connection to the land. You need land. It needs to be your land, which means Yosef sees that this is our land, while the brothers see that the brothers are essentially Bedouin. I mean, just think about it. The father lives all the way by Hebron, and they're with the flocks grazing, not so close, but, you know, by Shechem or even past Shechem, by Dothan, they're grazing. So therefore, there is this, again, disconnect between the farmer and between the rancher, and one has a firm connection to one piece of land and the other one doesn't. So now you read that back into this statement of the Bnei, we want this land, but this land for grazing. But hold it a second. First of all, it shows a lack of imagination, and I'm sorry for saying this, but it shows a lack of imagination in terms of getting to the next stage, where this is going to be the land. Again, Eretz Avad Chalav Udvash, it's going to be a land that you're going to grow, you know, you're going to have vines, and you're going to have your olive trees, and you're going to have all kinds of things. And they're just saying, but we have a lot of flock, and therefore this is where we're stuck. No. Cross over with everybody else, you know, build your farms, and then when it comes to grazing, just ask permission to have land for grazing. So all that I'm pointing out is there was another solution over here, and even their opening line of, you know, we have a lot of flock, and therefore we'd like to use this for grazing. So it could have been that on the other side of the Jordan would have been a confederation of property. I'm sorry, forgetting now into something which could be considered political. It could be a confederation of property owned by all 12 tribes, which could have been utilized by all 12 tribes for grazing area for everybody. You know, that could have been the suggestion. We want to cross with everybody else. We want to have our land. But when it comes to grazing season, we want to have permission to be able to use this. And that, therefore, what really strikes me in this whole thing is not just they're saying, okay, we have a lot of so on and so forth, but what did they say? Al ta'avirenu at ha'Yarden. Don't make us cross the Jordan. That's what bothers me more than the other part. It's not just that they want to, it's not that they want to work over there. It's that they don't want to live over there. So again, I've never saw anybody phrase it the way that I just now did. It strikes me that there's something very true about what I just now said. I know I don't have to grade, you know, what I say, but there is something over here. And Moshe's response, I think, goes along the way that I'm going, and he thinks it's much worse. I mean, Moshe's just saying to himself, okay, who were the last people who said that we don't want to cross over and this is going to be too dangerous, and that is the spies and the Meraglim. And what he goes, and the way that Moshe goes with this is, not only did their desire to stay out do something terrible, you know, in terms of their own values, but it caused everyone else to be frightened. And he says that you're doing the same thing. And I don't know if there's any worse thing that Moshe could have said, is that you are going to weaken the resolve of the people, and there's something which is horrific about that. So that's essentially his approach. The other thing is just in terms of personal sensitivity, you know, Moshe has been told that he can't cross over and he's going to die over here. And Moshe very much would like to go over and say to Moshe, you know, your punishment that you have, we'd like to join you in this. And again, there's something which is very, very wrong about that. There are those who try to flip it around and explain it other ways, but it's not that easy to reconcile it within the verses themselves. In Pasuk Vav, Yom Moshe El Gad Bnei Ruvain, Ha'achechem Yavo L'Milchama V'Tem Toshvu Po. So this refusal of crossing over, Moshe just hurls at them an accusation, which is a moral accusation, saying, and your brothers are going to continue along the way, and they're going to go to war, and they're going to fight for this land, and you're just going to sit over here. And then he continues, V'lamatini un et lev Bnei Yisrael. You know, why do you want to cause fear in their hearts? From going to the land which was given by God. And that's really going to be an important phrase, the land given by God. And then he references it back to the spies. That's what the spies did. They caused fear. To come to the land which God has given. So again, notice which God has given, the land of God, and so on. And that caused, of course, this terrible, terrible consequence where it was decided that this is the punishment, that this generation will never come to this land. These people will not get, again, the land promised to Avni Tzakov. V'ichar af Hashem b'Yisrael, v'yini'im b'midbar b'im shana. Atom Kolodoro Seharabi Ne'ashem, which is really interesting because, you know, these people know where we're up to in history, and Moshe's telling it over. He goes, this is who you are. This is what you're doing. This is what it means to stay behind. V'nikamtem tachav davotechem, tarbut anashim chataim. And now you've replaced them, a generation, a culture, or people who are sinning or sinners. L'sfot od al charon af Hashem Yisrael. You're going to cause more anger to descend on Israel. So we'll skip a little bit. Pasuk Ted Zayin, V'yigshu Eila V'yomer, Gidrotso Nivne L'Mekneinu Po. No, we're going to build things for the flock, V'arim L'Tapenu, and also build cities or fortified places to live for our children. So, of course, the Midrash points out that Moshe will then flip that around and that their values were wrong. It was their Mekneh, which has caused them to be more concerned about what they own than their children themselves. Just think about this. If they're going to be involved in the war, which they say they will be, that's the next verse, then they'll be away from their children for at least the next 14 years during the wars and this and so on. V'anachnu chatz chushim lefnei b'nei Yisrael ad asher im hivi unum el mikomam v'yashav tapenu ba'arei hamivtsar m'bnei yoshvei aretz. Right? And our children will sit in these fortified places. Lo nashuv el beitenu ad hitnachel bnei Yisrael ish nachlato. We're not going to go back home till everybody has their place. Ki lo ninachel itam me'ever liyardim. But they say it again. But we're not going to inherit on the other side of the Jordan. V'hala. Ki ba nachalenu elenu me'ever yardin mizracha. We want to be on the other side of the Jordan. I hope that you all find this quite disturbing, because it is. V'yomer le'emoshe im ta'asun et devar hazeh. imtechletzu lefnei Hashem lemelchama. Notice, and there, I didn't bold that one, but lefnei Hashem is used many, many times in the next number of verses. Moshe eventually acquiesces to them if they keep this vow, which means essentially you don't want to live in the land of Israel. I mean, I will remind you that this is a punishment not to be in the land of Israel. From Moshe's perspective, it's a punishment. If you don't want to be there, so then at least do the moral thing and, you know, go to the war, right? Sign up for the army, go to Miluim. Even if you need to live outside of the country, at least do, you know, your moral obligation. Of course, I'm not saying anything about today. I mean, again, the land will be captured in front of God. And then you'll be clear. And that land, I hear some unhappiness in Moshe's words over here, but I'm not sure if they did. So, if you don't do this, you would have sinned against God. Right, your sin will find you. B'nu lechem arim l'tapchem, and here's where Moshe switches the order. Build places for your children, u'gederot l'tzonchem, and then build the places for the animals. And in Kafhei, they accept upon themselves, and they switch the order in Pasuk Avav, they'll build the places, and so on. And then the result of all this is Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Vayanu b'nei Gad v'nei Ruvain. Notice also the order there has shifted as well. It's not the first time, by the way. Initially, it was b'nei Ruvain and Gad, and now it's become b'nei Gad and b'nei Ruvain. Lemor et asher diber Hashem elav adecha ken na'aseh. And then they end up the same way they began, you know, as God has spoken to the servants, and we accept, you know, and we will do this. And they spell it out again, Lamed Bet, Lamed Gimel is the result. Vayitain lahem Moshe levnei Gad v'levnei Ruvain. So again, notice that that's the sequence. V'lachatzi shevet Menashe ben Yosef et mamlechet Sichon melech Emoriv et mamlechet Og melech Habashan ha'aretz la'reel b'gvulot areya aretz saviv. And what we're somewhat mystified about is where in the world did the half of the tribe of Menashe get involved in all this? Because they were never involved in the negotiations. Not only were they not involved in negotiations, they were not involved in making the declaration that we will do this and we will do this and then you'll do this, which means that that all of this was supposedly conditional. I mean, so much of this was about the condition. And in fact, those of you who don't know, part of the laws of conditions are based upon this, which has to be a doubled condition, that you say this, and yes, we'll do this. And that's why there are so many words over here, because it could have been a lot less words, but we actually learned things out from this. But B'nai Menashe were just not involved in any of these negotiations, and they never accepted upon themselves this condition. They never said that we're going to first capture the land, we're going to send our children to the army, and so on and so forth. And again, where did they get involved in this? How did they get thrown into this? And that is going to be our main question that we're going to deal with. We're then told afterwards, v'yivnu b'nei Gad et divon v'tarav et arer, and so on. U'v'nei ruon b'nut cheshbon v'etalav et kiratayim. So therefore, the two different tribes built their things. And then we're told back again about the b'nei Menashe, v'yichu b'nei Machir ben Menashe Gilada. They went to a place called Gilad, v'yilkadua, and they captured it. And they captured and they defeated the Emori that were there. And Moshe gave them this land that they had captured. So it's not just that they captured it and then they kept it. They captured it and then Moshe gave it to them. And by the way, we kind of wonder, you know, if this would have mentioned before we read the other part, then maybe it would have been a little bit clearer to us if that would have been the sequence. So, what is Menashe doing here? Source number two, the Chizkuni, without telling you, he mentions something, he quotes something from Medrash Rabbah in Bereshit. The Chatzi Shevet Menashe, B'nei Menashe lo shalu lahem nachala be'eret Sichon va'og, rak b'nei Ruvin b'nei v'gad sha'alu. They never asked. Ela sha'ayadei sha'avim garam lem l'shvatim shekaru bigdeim b'matzei agaviyah, that because Menashe caused the brothers to tear their clothing, their inheritance was torn and placed on two sides of the river. Now, I hope you realize, Menashe, so I hope you realize this is not such a simple statement. First of all, you ask Menashe. I mean, what we're told is that Yosef sent somebody. So here, I guess this is one of our many theories of conservation of characters. Well, okay, we know that Yosef had a son, and therefore this must be the same person. And you know that that's not the easiest thing that I've ever said, but that's the assumption of the Midrash, that the one who went and said, oh, you stole the Gavia, was in fact Menashe. I'm just going to say it again. There's no hint of that in the Chumash itself, and says because Menashe was the one who pointed out to them, oh, you stole the Gavia, maybe stuck it back in their bags, and then they tear their clothing, so his inheritance gets torn into two places. I hope most of you realize that that's not necessarily pshat. It's not necessarily pshat, and even as a drash, it's not an easy drash either. Bad thing. The thesis is a bad thing. It goes through, I spared you the Midrash itself, but if you want, I'll show it to you. No one else. But the Midrash goes through a number of different, she's looking over here, it's my wife, okay? Don't. She didn't hold it, what did she do? So, that she's getting punished like this. But it goes through a whole bunch of people that caused kriya, and therefore, because it doesn't necessarily, in reality, seem to be a punishment. Rav Hirsch tells us something which I hope resonates. Source number 3. He says, we do not know the motives. We don't know the causes. We do not know. Which means, okay, say it. We don't know why this happened. This is unknown. We have no idea. Why Menashe got involved in this. And then he says, and there's a longer Ramban, which I only gave you a part in source 5, but he's going to give you his takeaway of the Ramban. He says, Al pi hasharat haRamban, according to the Ramban's, now what phrase do you want to use for hashara? Estimation, guesstimation, or the Ramban's read on this. It's assumption. It's his working assumption. According to the Ramban, what he thinks is going on, because again, just think of what Reverse said. First, we don't know. Done. Why don't we know? Because we're not told. We don't know how they got involved in this. Okay? Done. And he says, but based upon the Ramban's assumption, the way that he understands it, nitgale bishat chalukat ha'aretz shehi gdola michtei tzorech shnei hashvatim, that they came to this realization that the land on the other side was bigger than the needs of those two tribes, and therefore half of Menashe joined in at the end. The Tziv in source 4 says, "L'chatzis shevet Menashe kan lo k'tiv libnei chatzis shevet Menashe libnei b'shem shayu bam harbe mi bnei Yehuda kimuvor b'seifet dvarim," and so on. "U'l'chatzis shevet Menashe heima lo b'kshu, they never asked to go there kimuvor b'yushalmi bikurim." So, he just now brought in a discussion, the Yerushalmi Bikurim, which is a halachic discussion, which we're going to get to, hopefully, in a moment. And he says, they never asked. How do I know they never asked? Well, look, the Yerushalmi says they never asked. Ela Moshe bikesh mehem. Moshe made the request, kimvuar hatam b'sefer devarim, kidesh yu sham b'nei Torah. That Moshe sees that these people are better characters, and the Bnei Reuven and Gad need someone to actually teach them. And, you know, it's interesting because the Yosef family has a very good reputation as Zionists. Somehow there is this wonderful midrash about the Ma'pilim, and the midrash, the Torah talks about Ma'pilim, but the midrash claims that it's from the tribe of Ephraim. Why that is, I'll try to explain in a moment. We have the Benot Slavchad. We have Yosef asking to be buried back in Israel. So they have a reputation of being Zionists, which makes it very interesting about why Menashe then would counter this. So according to the way that the Netziv is saying it, is that no, we're sending them, I can't use this word, on shlichut, in order to try to bring back or to teach or to educate these other people who really have the wrong values. I do want to point something out, and this you don't, And I do want to point something out. You don't have this in front of you right now. So, and if you ask, then I will send this to you. I have a chart which has the census as it was taken in the beginning of Bamidbar and the census as it was taken last week, and what the differentials are on each one. So we also remember, let's remember another thing, that we have four camps. We have our Reuven camp, our Yehuda camp, right? We have our Dan camp, and we have our Bnei Rachel camp, or Yosef camp, over here. And the Reuven camp, Reuven, Shimon, and Gad, all three of them, during the time in the desert, went down in population. If I look, on the other hand, at the Yehuda camp, Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zvulun, all three of them went up in population, which means we have a camp over here which is a negative camp. I will admit that the biggest negative is actually Shimon, who we don't hear from at all, but if we'll just think about it a little differently, over the time in the desert, were there any negative aspects with Reuven, where any people from Reuven may have died? So we'll see something about that in a moment. So if you want to take us to the Korach, look at source number 6. V'yikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kah ben Levi v'dan v'ram b'nei Eliyahu b'nei Reuven. And what do they say? Lo na'aleh, which is just very interesting. Lo na'aleh, we always thought the no, lo na'aleh was, we're not going to come to Moshe, but there may be something much deeper there. Hama'ad keli tanu mi'eret zavad chalav u'dvash. You took us out of a place, which is Ezra zavad chalav u'dvash, which means the attitude of at least some people in Bnei Reuven, and again, we don't know how many of the people involved over here in this sin were from Bnei Reuven, but there is this cynicism towards the land of Israel. You could have said, no, the cynicism is to Moshe, but they're describing, you took us out of a place that flows in land which flows in milk and honey, and they call that to Egypt. That's a cynicism towards the land of Israel. Even if you're upset, that is not the right thing to say. You don't insult the land of Israel because you're upset with Moshe. So it's just very interesting. There's lo na'aleh, we're not going to go up, and they insult the land of Israel, and then we find again the amount of people who die from that whole camp, which is, they're missing 2,770 from Reuven, 37,100 from Shimon, which is more than just the 24,000 who died there, and 5,150 from Gad. So these three tribes have been negative tribes. On the other hand, so I mentioned Yehudi, Yisachar, and Zvulun are up 1,900, 9,900, 3,100. And of course, there is going to be a standard deviation that a statistician can come and look at all of this. But the fact that all three are negative and all three are positive may be an indication of something. Ephraim is down 8,000. I'm willing to, and on the other hand, Menashe and Binyamin. Menashe is up 20,500 and Binyamin is up 10,200. If I would use just who is up and who is down, you know, they have these things trending up and trending down. So if I were to look just at the numbers over here to give me an indication of a positive tribe versus a negative tribe, and again, having more children is not necessarily the sign of, but it's maybe an indication not of a sign of anything other than these people are having plague striking them, and these people are making really bad decisions. So it's interesting that 8,000 people are missing from Ephraim. So that, I think, is the motivation of the Midrash, that they were the Ma'apilim. Okay, they're the Zionists because they're from Yosef. But what's their mistake? They go up before it's time, and that's why we're missing from Ephraim. But on the other hand, if you look at Menashe, they go up from 32,000, you know, in the Sefer Bamidbar, up to 52,700, which is really an extreme, you know, as extreme the down of Shimon is, 37,000. So this is the second biggest differential, going up 20,000. Let's say presumably over 40 years, but it's... The other one, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. So Dan is up and Asher is up. Dan is up 1,700 and Asher is up 11,900. And Naphtali's also missing 8,000. So Naphtali, by the way, is the big mystery over here. I mean, why do we assume? See, essentially, we assume that Yosef is good and we assume that Yosef is Zionist. So therefore, we assume that Ephraim died in an honorable way. And Naphtali is the big mystery why they're down 8,000. So I'm just going to leave it at that. But then it becomes very interesting that Reuven and Gad, negative tribes, and then Menashe, very, very, the most positive tribe as it was. And again, you can now tell me that this whole decision was because they have grown so much over this time that suddenly, not that they're bigger than Yehuda in terms of absolute numbers, Yehuda's absolute number is 76,000, Yisachar is 64,000, Zvulun is 60,000, nonetheless, Menashe grew the most from 32 to 52,000 or 52,700. And therefore, they feel perhaps that, you know, we're going to need some kind of space. But I'll say in absolute terms, they're not as big as some of the other tribes. And therefore, they need to go over. What was said before is correct, that the amount of that they end up getting is, you know, it's like they got Texas. I mean, it's a huge, huge amount. Let's now move over to that Yerushalmi that we were told we need to learn. It's in source number 8, and the Yerushalmi, to understand it, we first need to read source number 7. Source number 7 talks about a mitzvah which is called the mitzvah of Bikurim. When you come to the land which God gave you as an inheritance. So I just want you to think about those words a second. The land which God gave you as an inheritance. So what land did God give you as an inheritance? So I grew up in Brooklyn. So is that the land that God gave me as an inheritance, or is that just the place that I ended up living? V'yirashta v'yashafta ba. And you, again, there is a particular mitzvah to inherit it and to settle there. That, by the way, is a mitzvah. Good. V'lakachta mereshit kol pri adama, and you're supposed to take from the first fruits, which grow, asher tavi mi'artzecha, from your land, asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach, the land which God gave you. V'yuvila makom hazeh, v'yiten lanu et ha'aretz hazot, right, you bring it, and then you make this whole declaration, and it ends up by saying, v'yuvienu ala makom hazeh, and God brought us to this place, v'yinu lanu et ha'aretz hazot, and God gave us this land, Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. Now, the argument in the Mishnah in Bikurim will be, what if you happen to live on the other side of the Jordan River? Are you able to say any of these things? Are you able to say, well, this is the land that God gave me? Are you able to say that this is the land which flows with milk and honey? Are you able to say that this is, which means, I'm not arguing whether the east bank of the Jordan is part of the land of Israel. I'm asking whether that can be considered the land which God intended to give us, Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. Now let's read the Mishnah. Elam Uvian Vikorin, and these are the people who bring the Bikurim and they say over the Parsha when they bring it, right? And Minatzeret, we're going to skip a little bit, and it says at the very end, you bring it, Mina Perot Shebaharim, Mina Terim Shebamakim, Mizete Shemen, Ume Ever Liyardain. So the first opinion of the Mishnah is you do bring it from the other side of the Jordan. Rabbi Yosef Haglili, Rabbi Yosef, who lived in the Galilee, Omer, Ein Mervin Bikurim Eiver Yardain. You can't bring it from Eiver Yardain. She'enu Eretz Zavat Chalav Dvash. It's just not the land which is described as the land which flows with milk and honey. So therefore, he says that it can't be brought from there. Right. It's an excellent question. It's not an excellent question. Sorry, I take that back. But that doesn't answer his question. That's not his question. I know, but that doesn't answer his question. His question is, did God sign off on this or not? And here, does God sign off on this of their living over here? That's his question. And we're not told here. It could be, if you look a little bit more in Sefer Devarim, you may have more of an indication. Let's look at the Gemara now. The Gemara begins now, 3 lines from the bottom on page 2. Rav Yosi b'Shimon ben Lakish. So I'm just going to skip a little bit. It starts describing the land, and it says, well, this part over here, within this area over here, we're not getting into all, although, by the way, he is describing area near the Galilee, which may be interesting. Hein hein eretz zavat chalav udvash. Am Rabbi Yonah, second line again on the from the top of the page, they asked Rabbi Yonah's position. Tani, asher natata li, land which you gave me, lo shenatalti li biatzmi, and not land which I took by myself. My binaihun, what's going to be the difference, which means, is the problem going to be, in terms of Bikurim, of not bringing it, is the problem going to be, when I say make the declaration, okay, I hope I didn't lose you right there, when I read the verses, the problem was, and this is back in the declaration of number 7, I have to make the declaration and say, v'yaveu el makom hazeh v'yitein lanu et ha'aretz, Hazot Eretz Zavat Chalot Dvash. Is the problem that this land was not given by God? It's not Vayitein Lanot Haaretz, which goes back to your question. So according to that, no, God never gave it. God never agreed in that. And therefore, that part isn't true. That's why I can't bring Bikurim from there. Or is the problem not that God never gave it to me? God did give it to me, but it's not Eretz Zavat Chalot Dvash. So the Gemara then says, well, what's going to be the difference between these two different positions? Is the problem that God didn't give it, or is the problem, because what God had promised all along was, you know, on this side of the Jordan. So it says, Maybe Nahum, what's the difference in the two approaches? Amar Rabbi Avin Chatzi Shefi Menashe Benayim. Manda Amar Shenatatali Vishalanatatili Miatzmi. When it talks, if the reason is that I have to say which God gave me, not which I took by myself. Chatzi shevet Menashe lo natnu me'atzman. They didn't take by themselves, which is interesting because we have no idea how they got involved. It actually, I could have argued the opposite. I could have argued the verses afterwards say they went to war and they took it by themselves. I could have said that they took it and then Moshe afterwards signs up, but not in terms of God giving it. But I'm saying this is the opposite. And it says, Manda Amar Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. But if the problem is land that's not Zavat Chalav Udvash, Afilu Kain Eino Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. That even if God agreed, even if Moshe agreed, even everybody signed off on it, but it doesn't make a difference because it's not Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. Now, of course, and now is where I get into a little bit of the halachic problem with all of this, is the ruling like Rabbi Yossi? Is the conclusion of the Yerushalmi like Rabbi Yossi? And therefore, is the other side of the Yarden not considered to be Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash? Which means over here we have two different reasons to say that you can't bring Bikurim from there. By the way, there is Trumot and Maestrot and other things, but you can't bring Bikurim from there. So it gets into a very funny status. It is considered to be part of Eretz Yisrael, but it's not considered to be what was promised. And therefore, it's not Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. And therefore, it's saying the difference between these different approaches is what is the status of Chatzi Shefet Menashe. Now, I want to go back a little bit because I have a suggestion, which is a different solution to this, and I will readily admit could not be easily read into what I just now read in the Gemara, but I'm for right now more concerned with the Psukim than I am with the Gemara. And there are other places in what's called Medrash Halacha which deal with some of these issues. And I saw one commentary, the Birkei Yosef, go into some of what I'm talking about now, and I cut and pasted it. It came out to be like 30, 40 pages in my... So I didn't send you all of those sources, but if you want, it could be for your homework. If you look at source number two, it's number nine. This is the first time that the phrase is used, Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. It has never been used in Sefer Bereishit. It is only used for the first time in source number 9, when God speaks to Moshe at what we call the burning bush. But then it gives us a very interesting comment on that. El makom haknani vachiti vaemori vaprizi vachivi vayivusi. Incidentally, how many are mentioned there? Six. So, okay. So I'm just stop. Lech va'safta pasuk yud zayin v'amar elet chemei oni mitzrayim el eretz haknani v'achiti v'amori v'aprizi v'chivi v'yusi el eretz zavat chalav udvash. So now I have a definition of what eretz zavat chalav udvash is. So let me tell you the beginning of my problem, and we'll see what we're going to end up doing with this. Look on page 4 on the bottom. I gave you a beautiful picture. Yes. Of course, and my sources, it's in color. So, everything about biblical maps is conjecture. I just have to say that. That you look at three different maps, you'll have three different descriptions of things. I took a map, and I cut off the copyright over here. This is a map from the Art Scroll Chumash. I hope they don't sue me. But I changed it. So when you steal something and you change it, so then you make an acquisition of it, so they can sue me for everything now. But this was a map that they had used in order to show the 42 different stops, which I cut off almost all of that because that didn't concern me. I just wanted the upper part over here for you to see a couple of things. Now, my description of, you look, I put in Reuven, I put in Gad, I put in Menashe. And that's my wonderful writing on my computer and my typing and so on. So Menashe, Gad, and Reuven is what I put in. And you'll see that Reuven is on the other side of the Jordan. It's actually the other side of Yam HaMelech. Now, I can't guarantee that. I can't guarantee exactly how far north and how far south, but they're on that side. Gad, on the other hand, I also can't guarantee the exact contours of where Gad is, but Gad is on the other side of the Yarden. And now, you look where Menashe is. Menashe is much further up. Menashe is in what you would call today the Golan Heights. Here, when I said that there's going to be a huge implication in terms of halacha, well, are the Golan Heights considered to be Me'ever HaYarden, the other side of the Yarden? Now, I just hope that the logic over here is going to win out. Whether it's part of Israel or not, I want to leave for a moment, or was biblically part of Israel, was intended to be part of Israel, all that I want to leave out for a moment. But at least when I use the phrase Me'ever HaYarden, the other side of the Yarden, which is going to be used various times, I would assume, and I could be wrong, that the Yarden would be the description between the Kinneret and the Dead Sea. Why would I think that? Because that's what's called the Yarden. Now, you could tell me I'm wrong about that, and you can tell me that the water which goes into the Yarden, which I think there's multiple... Yeah, but is only one? There's multiple things that go into... Right. So is the water north of the Kinneret also going to be called Me'ever HaYarden? That, by the way, is actually the question in all of this. Because if that's Me'ever Yarden, then all of this is Me'ever Yarden. But if the Yarden is only south of the Kinneret, again, I don't care right now what we call it. I care what the halach. I'm looking at Shuli because Shuli's a tour guide. If you ever need a tour guide, then you hire Shuli. And if you notice, there is some water over there, which is right where my pen went. There is some water over there, and I don't know exactly where Menashe is, but I'm troubled by something else completely. And let's go back, and you will very quickly come to the realization what it is that bothers me. If you look at my map, you're going to notice that where God is sitting, and I can't guarantee you right now where all of these borders really are, there is something which is called Eretz HaEmori. So if you notice, you have Eretz Canaan, Eretz Plishtin, Eretz Edom, Eretz Moav, Eretz HaEmori, and I'm going up, Eretz HaBashan. There's some complication with the Emori, and that's because, do you remember that this is part of what we had noticed a couple of weeks ago, is that they captured land which had previously belonged to Moav. So therefore, in terms of Eretz HaEmori, and actually you see those big red cloud things, those are wars that took place over there. So you have one war taking place a little lower under God, another war taking place over God. So by Eretz HaEmori, how much of this is Eretz HaEmori? And in case you don't realize why that's a problem, go back now to the description that we had by the burning bush. What were the name of the places? The name of the places were Eretz HaKnani v'Chiti v'HaEmori. But the Emori would seem to be on the other side of the Jordan. Now, if the real Emori is further north, that means that the Emori are the Golan Heights. So if the Emori is the Golan Heights, why am I working so hard over here? And I hope you just now realize what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting is a possibility that B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven, they asked for land that was never supposed to be part of what was promised, and therefore they're asking for something which is not part of Eretz Zevat Chalav U'Dvash, but I'm claiming that Eretz HaEmori is Eretz Zevat Chalav U'Dvash, and that's what's given to Menashe, so therefore, based on what I'm saying, and I'm saying I cannot easily reconcile this with that Yerushalmi, because then it would come out that, you know, what are you talking about? It makes a difference between, you know, whether it's this reason or this reason. I know, don't trust, I'm saying that that's what's part of the difficulty here, but where exactly is the MRE? And again, it's worthwhile reading the descriptions of this, but what I'm claiming then is that there's a possibility that where God and Reuven R is the other side of the Jordan that was never considered Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, and it could be then God turns around to Menashe and gives them this. Now that would actually be very interesting, because why is God giving to Menashe this land if it's considered to be part of the land of Israel? Why is this land somehow being separated? And of course the other problem is, and this is, I've said this already, I just want this to be clearer. So what happens when the Emori capture other land? Which means that you have what I would call true parts of these various tribes that are mentioned. And I say tribes over here, I mean the Prizi and the Yevusi and so on. And then, Yevusi was mentioned there, I'm not sure. Yeah. And then I have the things which they may have captured. And we know specifically with the Emori that they captured things just further down, lower down, which is why your map is confusing, because that also indicates what how the Emorites went and captured what was lower down. But just because they captured it doesn't turn it retroactively into Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. Now, note something in Source 11. Going all the way back to the Brit Bein Abtarim, God got, I think, the part of Emori which was captured from Moab, which was actually the reason, that was the background of why Balak got involved in all of this. Okay, so that's part of what we'll see there. No, that's from the MRE. Yeah, so let's now continue and take a look. In source number 11, this is the Brit Bein Abtarim. God says, I'm going to give the land, but v'dorav Yishua hena ki lo shalein avon ha-MRE ad hena. It's specifically, the MRE don't deserve to lose their land yet, so therefore I can't send you in. And then it says, etakni, etakniziv, etakamoniv, etakitiv, aprizi, etarifaim, etamariv, etakniv, etagirgashiv, etayivusi. So basically, it says, this is the land I'm giving to you, right? Bayomahu karata shem Avraham brit lemor, lazarchar natati etaaretz azot, minhar mitzrayim anahar gadol nahar prat. Etakini veetakinizi veetakadmoni veetachiti veetaprizi veetarifaim veetamori veetaknani veetagirgashi veetivusi. You ask about Og. Look at source 12. Vayater hagilad v'chol habashan. That's the part which goes to Menashe. Mamlechet Og natati lechatzi shevet haMenashe. Kol ha-chevel ha-argov l'chol ha-bashan hu yikra eretz rifaim. Rifaim was mentioned earlier, right? Ve'et ha-rifaim. And look what Rashi says. Hu yikra eretz rifaim hi ota shenatati la-Avraham. I don't know how much clearer I can get based upon this Rashi, but of course this Rashi was until Devarim, so this Rashi didn't help us at all in this week's parsha. But do you realize what we now know? Which means there's a difference between under the Kinneret versus over the Kinneret. And based on this Rashi, yes, I hope you're appreciating this Rashi. Are you enjoying this as much as me? That when you read this Rashi, it says that, again, just read Pasuk, read Source 12, Pasuk Yud Gimel, talking about what was given to Menashe. The Yeter HaGilad, the Chol HaBashan Mamlechet Og, Natati Lechatzi Shevet Menashe. And it ends up, Hu Yikarei Eretz Rifaim, Rashi, He ota shenatati la'Avraham, right? So this is what was given to Avraham. So what then does this mean? Now again, you can begin to argue, okay, that's not necessarily Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, but do you want to go back there again and read that pasuk that was said to Moshe? What country was included there, or what people were included? Ha'emori are included in what's described as Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. If that's the case, then my solution with Menashe, again, there's still something strange going on. What's strange? What's strange is, why is Menashe being given this part now? Why not just wait? Well, the answer may be because they're, why is this happening now? Why don't we go till we cross? Well, the answer is maybe because they captured it. Maybe the sequences over here is not the correct sequence. Again, as I said, they go to war, they capture this, and then they're told, okay, you know, we're already giving things out, so we're going to give Reuven and Gad what they want, which is not part of what was ever promised to Avraham, and you can keep that. It becomes part of Eretz Israel, but it's never going to be called Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. On the other hand, what is being given to Menashe is part of what was promised to Avraham and is considered to be Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. I still have, I have lots of problems, but he's told where he has to be buried. So Moshe, that's right. Correct. Correct. Moshe could not go over there, and that would have been Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. Which means what I'm saying is that the other side of the Jordan, and again, please, did I qualify myself in the beginning? Is if what I'm saying is correct, then there are huge implications. First of all, I want to point out somebody who absolutely disagrees with me, and that's going to be the Or HaChaim in source number 15, and he's going to claim that just like Menashe had land on two sides of the Yarden, even though it's hard for me to call that the Yarden, he's saying so did the Emori. He's claiming that the Emori also had a foothold on the other side, and therefore that's the part which was considered to be Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, and that's the part which was allowed. So he's claiming that there's two different sides. So therefore, I hope that's going to be clear that he seems to disagree with what I'm saying. Look at source 15. If you look three lines from the bottom, Ze'inu Kushya Ki Areha Emoriha Amorim B'Sichon Eina Mashenatan Hashem La'avaram Kamo Shegila Katuv Bif. But again, that's another issue. So meaning his proof that there's two different parts, I'm saying it's north and south, he's saying that it's east and west, if I'm understanding this correctly, but I'm not sure what actually leads him to that. On the other hand, he's going back to the verse, which again, this has to be considered, and that's why our map is all messed up, when the Emori captured the land from Moab. So that's certainly Me'ever HaYarden. My question is that Me'ever HaYarden, right? If you look at your map still, if you look where God is, and you see like the little things of war, and you see Eretz Emori, that's Eretz Emori captured from Moab. Now the question is, so where's the real Eretz Emori? Is it further north, or is it to the left? Rashi is right, or to the west. Rashi was saying Eretz Rephaim. That's what was promised to Avram. That's what was given to Menashe. Rashi is telling me it's north. So I'm just working with Rashi over here. As I said, within the Or HaChaim, you can begin to argue. On the other hand, I did find somebody who I believe agrees with me, and you have no idea how hard I had to work on this. And that's the Griz. The Griz is Revelvel Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik's uncle. And it's in source number 16, and we'll read a little bit, and we'll conclude with this. Vayitain lo Moshe lechatzi shevet Menashe ben Yosef. In lo matzinu shehitne Moshe gam im chatzi shevet Menashe. We never found that there was any kind of deal made with them. Rak im b'nei Gad v'ruvein. Right? That's something we had pointed out earlier. V'kevin shekein de mitzad adin srichin hoyu lachoz be'eretz Yisrael. Rak de nitchadsha lacha she'im yikayim utunayim yikablu shama chelkan b'yirusha ta'aretz. Aval im lo yimakaimim harehu chozer adin l'kichadchila sheyirushtam be'eretz Yisrael b'mokam she'nicharei tabrit u'mokam she'lo nicharei tabrit hayashayach l'chol Yisrael v'gam l'kohanim. Essentially saying is that what would have happened to this land? So this is what I said in the very beginning. This land could have been grazing land or land collectively owned by the entire Jewish people without any of the tribes going there. So this would have been land belonging to everybody. So what happened when they made this whole conditional deal? So what happened then? It became their, it's part of Eretz Yisrael, and it became their land. But again, parenthetically, it's not Eretz Devad Chalav Udvash. Aval chatzi sheven menashe shehin kiblu Eretz Og kidichtiv bidvarim v'ktiva hu yikra Eretz Rafaim pirsh Rashi hi otosh natati la'avram ad kan l'shono. So that's the Rashi that we had seen. There was a covenant on that land, which means that's what God had promised to Avram. So of course that's part of the land. That always should have been part of the land of Israel divided to the 12 tribes. So the only thing that changed is that even without the goral, it was given to them. Therefore, there needed to be no condition made with them because this was always part of Eretz Israel. The other part was not. So essentially, he's saying that there, in terms of halacha, and he's talking halacha here, that there is a difference between the land of Israel captured and given to Reuven and Gad. That's land which is captured. Captured, therefore, belongs to the collective. Captured does not make it any tribal affiliation. When they set up this whole Tanai, the Tanai was needed for them to then acquire it based on fulfilling the conditions, again, within this Tanai, within this deal. He goes, on the other hand, why don't we find a deal made with Menashe? Because nothing was needed to do to turn this into the land of Israel, because it is the land of Israel. How do I know it's the land of Israel? That's what was promised to Abraham. So therefore, we now end up, I think, with a whole, you know, different insight into the difference between B'nai Reuven and God on the one hand, B'nai Menashe on the other hand. B'nai Reuven and God chose to stay outside the land of Israel, outside of what we would call Eretz Zvat Chalav U'Dvash, its land which was captured, was given over, and then for de facto becomes part of Eretz Yisrael, but it's not what was promised to Avram, and it was not what was told to Moshe, is part of the, again, the land which flows with milk and honey. On the other hand, the land where Chatzi Shevet Menashe go, that's land which they captured, but they captured, if you want, they liberated land which was promised to Avraham and land which was described to Moshe as Eretz Zvat Chalav U'Dvash, which makes it 100% in the land of Israel. So what did we end up with all of this? The Golan is part of Eretz Yisrael and is a land which flows with milk and honey, and you have to be careful about the laws of Shemitah and all kinds of other land laws which perhaps apply over there. Again, I may have just not gone too far, but at least this is Eretz Yisrael according to Rashi and certainly according to the Griz.